From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's check in on Hurricane Lane, which is lashing parts of Hawaii with more than 30 inches of rain. The flooding is catastrophic on the Big Island. It's now a Category 2 hurricane. Residents are bracing for the worst storm in a quarter century. Brooke Bingaman is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. She is in Honolulu. Brooke, at this point, it looks like the biggest concern is all the rain. Is that your sense?
Yes, flooding has always been one of our primary concerns, although another concern that we also have for today into tomorrow is the dangerous surf that will also be approaching many of the islands. We could see anywhere from 15 to 25 foot waves approaching some of the shores. So we want people to be cautious of that because that will cause coastal flooding on top of the rain coming down, which could cause flooding, you know, running down from the mountains.
And when it comes to that rain, we're hearing about 31 inches of rain on the Big Island of Hawaii. What else are you seeing?
Yeah, the Big Island in the wettest spots that got hit the hardest so far by Hurricane Lane, there have been observations anywhere from 15 to a little over 30 inches. And for the forecast for the rest of the islands, still looking at potential totals of 10 to 20 inches, with some isolated spots getting 30 to 40 inches.
We read that five tourists were rescued from a home they were renting in Hilo. That's also on the Big Island. What are you advising people to do at this point?
Well, the main thing we've been advising everybody is to definitely be prepared and to stay aware of what the latest forecast is, and to definitely heed any local officials. If they are telling you to evacuate or to get to higher ground, then you definitely want to listen to their advice.
Do you expect the storm to weaken further as the time goes on?
Yes, the storm is still forecast to weaken within the next 24 to 48 hours. It's on track to continue moving north, and then between Saturday afternoon into the early morning hours of Sunday, it should be weakening and then heading to the west.
And do you feel like Hawaii dodged a bullet here, or is this as bad as people expected it would be?
Well, we may end up dodging a bullet in terms of direct landfall of the eye of the hurricane. But what I want people to understand is that the impacts, even away from the center of the hurricane, are still very life-threatening because there's the potential for multiple landslides, power outages extending for many days, if not into a week. And we just want people to be aware that these impacts are very strong. So it's difficult to say we've dodged a bullet because we're still expecting very dangerous threats.
That's Brooke Bingaman, meteorologist with the National Weather Service, joining us from Honolulu, Hawaii. Brooke, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Jeremy, Hurricane Lane is all over social media.
Yeah.
But we want to look at the rest of what's showing up there in our weekly roundup with Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello. And Femi, just want to ask you quickly about Senator John McCain, who is discontinuing treatment for brain cancer. A lot of people sharing their thoughts online. What are you seeing?
We learned this today online and on social from Meghan McCain, Senator McCain's daughter, posting this family statement, and also Cindy McCain posting the family statement as well. A sense of history from West Wing reports. They tweet, when John McCain replaced Barry Goldwater in the Senate in 1987, it was said that no one could fill Goldwater's shoes. McCain did. Two of the 20th century's most respected senators back to back. There is debate about Senator John McCain. It has been going on for quite a while. Governor Mike Huckabee, though, says he's sad to hear that the senator has stopped his medical treatment. But no one can deny his faithful service to our nation. Had times of disagreement with him, but always respected him and love for his family. But Robin, of course, being on Twitter, other people do not have that respect. So there are, even his fierce opponents are saying, this is not the time, this is not the place to be pushing your political agenda. We need to respect the family and the fact that they are grieving.
Yeah, well, and we should say for those who've just tuned in, Senator John McCain is still with us,
right,
but has said that he's going to stop.
Yes, and Robin, and only on social can you read your obituary while you're still alive. So people are actually saying he's a great man or he's not a great man, and he's alive and his family are still reading all of these comments. So it might be really good to just think about that before you head off on social.
What an interesting observation. You can read your obituary while you're live on social media. We want to turn to something else that's really lighting up social media. South Africans are slamming President Trump after he tweeted that he's directed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to examine South Africa's land and farm seizures from whites and the large-scale killing of farmers. Problem is, there are no farm seizures. The killing of farmers is at a 20-year low. The president quoted Tucker Carlson on Fox after Carlson said this.
The president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, has begun, and you may have seen this in the press, seizing land from his own citizens without compensation because they are the wrong skin color. That is literally the definition of racism. Racism is what our elites say they dislike most. Donald Trump is a racist, they say. But they paid no attention to this at all.
Again, the South African government is floating the idea of taking unused land from
buying it from the 8%
of white farmers who own 70% of the land there. This is an inequity that the government has been trying to correct since the end of apartheid.
They've taken decades, and they're really, really careful because it's such a contentious issue. And so into this contentious issue wades the President of the United States. Matt Horne says on Twitter, "Dear American friends, I am a white South African living in South Africa. I promise you the government is not taking white-owned land, nor is there a white genocide being perpetuated here. Your president," and then he says an interesting description, "Thanks, Matt."
Mm-hmm. Well, and by the way, people wonder where these things burble up from, why Tucker Carlson might have been speaking about this in a way that isn't true. But this is a white supremacist theory, and South African white supremacists came to the U.S. this past year to tour and lobby on this subject. Dylan Roof, the Charleston church shooter, was a follower of white supremacist groups that claimed that this was going to happen in South Africa, a genocide. So this has been burbling up. And the government, the South African government, has weighed in.
Oh, yes, they were not happy. The South African government, on their official Twitter feed, says, "South Africa totally rejects this narrow perception which only seeks to divide our nation and reminds of our colonial past." And then the former ambassador to South Africa from the US says, "This is what happens when you don't actually have an ambassador in South Africa." There are many diplomatic posts around the world right now that are currently vacant. And then one last one on this note here, and I would just say from Solly. Solly says, "He's not the president of the world or South Africa."
Yeah. Okay. So there is that story. I'm sure it will continue to burble. But meanwhile, I want to move to Beto O'Rourke. He's gone viral. Jeremy talked to this Texas congressman this week. You can hear it at hearnow.org. He's hoping to unseat Ted Cruz in the Senate. But he was at a town hall, and a man from a family of veterans stood up to say he was frustrated that people seemed okay with NFL player protests. He asked O'Rourke if he was okay with players taking a knee during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. Here's part of what Beto O'Rourke had to say.
"While the eyes of this country are watching these games, they take a knee to bring our attention and our focus to this problem to ensure that we fix it. That is why they are doing it. And I can think of nothing more American than to peacefully stand up or take a knee for your rights anytime, anywhere, any place. So thank you very much for..."
Now, he went on and on. He talked about civil rights, police shootings.
Absolutely.
But Ted Cruz also spoke as well. I mean, he obviously doesn't agree. He was at an event in Corpus Christi. Let's listen.
"He, quote, couldn't think of anything more American than kneeling to protest the national anthem. And I have to say, it was an interesting contrast because I said last week I was touring military bases. So at military bases, I was on the bases, and at the end of the day, each day, they would play retreat over the loudspeaker system. And every person on the base, every soldier, sailor, airman, marine, every civilian, you stopped what you're doing. We were in a van, we'd pull over on the side of the road. You'd get up and you'd stand at attention listening. Every single soul on the base."
So a powerful response, but Femi, it sounds like O'Rourke has really gone viral.
The reason why I wanted to share this with you, Robin, the O'Rourke video, first of all, was because when something like this goes viral, it's like wandering around and hearing the same hit song everywhere you go. They're playing at the supermarket. They're playing it when you're filling up with your gas. This is a bit like the O'Rourke video. And the reaction has been really interesting. "This is a must watch," yells Francesca, 1225. "Please watch it." Beto O'Rourke is a future president of the United States. Mark my words, he's a mix of Robert F. Kennedy and President Obama. This is hope. Nikki says, let me say now, I felt that Obama when I watched that clip. So there's lots of enthusiasm. People have been watching it, then going off and contributing to his campaign. Ted Cruz has been trying to push back, and he actually said just a little bit as a way to come back. He said it was a little bit like the Hollywood liberals are so excited about this video with O'Rourke siding with the NFL players protesting the national anthem that Kevin Bacon has just retweeted it. That means all of us can now win 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Lots of groans underneath this and people complaining about the wit in italics of Ted Cruz. This debate will continue.
But you know what? You have to be facile on social media. It's not just what you say to your, you know, constituents. You have to. It's the social media that amplifies it. Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
There is a new prime minister in Australia. Scott Morrison is taking over for Malcolm Turnbull after Turnbull was ousted by Liberal Party rivals in a bruising leadership battle. Today, Morrison pledged to bring stability to the country.
To keep our country together. To not pit one group of Australians against another. To ensure that one can succeed and all can succeed. That one doesn't have to fail for another one to succeed.
Joining us now is BBC senior reporter and former Sydney correspondent John Donison. He's in London. John, what do you make of this leadership change in Australia?
Well, it's a brutal business, Australian politics. They've changed their prime minister 6 times, I think, in the last 10 years. 5 different prime ministers in that period. One guy did it twice. And it is a really, really cutthroat business. You're talking about prime ministers lasting, on average, less than 2 years. And just a few days ago, you had Scott Morrison, who was Malcolm Turnbull's treasurer. He could be seen hugging Malcolm Turnbull and saying he was going to stick by him loyally. A few days later, that had all changed.
What does this mean politically? What is the difference between Morrison and Turnbull?
Well, it's confusing in Australia because their Conservative Party, a party which is conservative, I should say, is called the Liberal Party. But Malcolm Turnbull was a more liberal guy in the American use of the word than Scott Morrison. Scott Morrison is a bona fide conservative. So Malcolm Turnbull was in favour of legalising gay marriage, very progressive on issues like climate change, more progressive on issues like immigration. That is not the case of Scott Morrison. He is a social conservative. He rose to prominence as a very hardline immigration minister in a previous government. And it was he who led that campaign, you might remember, the Stop the Boats campaign, trying to stop boats carrying asylum seekers trying to reach Australia's shores. So you're going to see a shift to the right, I think. But really, this reflects a tendency in Australian politics to bear grudges. Malcolm Turnbull actually came to power with a similar leadership coup a couple of years ago when he ousted another right-wing Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. And the sense is, I think, that the right-wingers in his party have been plotting behind the scenes ever since then, trying to do him over, and they had their chance this week. And the big blow for Malcolm Turnbull was he was popular when he came to power, and he thought, right, I've got an election coming up, I'll get a big mandate, and then I can do what I want. The trouble was he didn't get the votes, and that left him pretty weak.
You mentioned the asylum seekers. That was an issue that came up between President Trump and Malcolm Turnbull. We remember that phone call in which Trump hung up on the Australian Prime Minister. What do you think that this change in leadership means for the relationship between Australia and the United States?
Well, certainly that issue you mentioned is going to be interesting how that develops, because under President Obama, a deal was done for America to take 1,250 refugees that Australia had settled in these offshore detention centres in the Pacific Islands of Nauru and also in Papua New Guinea. Now, Donald Trump was very, very unhappy about that deal but reluctantly said he would stick to it. And it was partly over that issue that he did clash with Malcolm Turnbull. Scott Morrison is equally tough on that issue. He certainly does not want those refugees, asylum seekers, to be coming to Australia. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that deal. I mean, my understanding is that only a couple of hundred of those 1,250 refugees have actually arrived in America at this point.
That's the BBC's John Donison. John, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
And now to Florence, Italy, a city that's been a tourist magnet for centuries, drawing people to the great Italian Renaissance artists in the famous museums. But this influx of tourists is so intense these days, it's putting a strain on that famous Italian benvenuto. Welcome. Reporter Anna Benstead has our story.
Imagine yourself on a dream holiday under the Tuscan sun in Florence, where the only hard decision of the day is
cioccolato, crema,
gelato related.
Pistacchio, nocciola.
But what if the reality of this Renaissance city turns out to be...
It's crazy. I think it's too busy.
A place where hot and bothered tourists describe themselves.
Too many.
Where lines to the major museums clog the beautiful piazzas.
We're not going to go see Duomo today because the line is just too long.
And where the visitors feel sorry for the residents.
I think it must be a nightmare to be Florentine.
I was born here 62 years ago and I always lived in town till now. But now I start doubting.
Fausto Calderai, an art expert in Florence, is at the end of his tourism tether.
Rubbish everywhere, and you can see the pedestrian way completely destroyed. I walk from my home along the river till Santo Spirito, where my office is. I really feel so depressed.
Okay, guys, we're actually moving on the opposite side.
And it's not just Florence. Venice is installing turnstiles to limit numbers to its famous piazzas. Barcelona has signs from residents saying, "Tourists go home, refugees welcome." Walk through Florence and the palazzo-lined streets are packed. The centre's small, with only 380,000 residents, but 5 million visitors make it their destination every year.
She's just taking a picture.
Sorry.
It's almost impossible to stop and look up at the glory of its Renaissance cathedral without tripping over or being tripped over by other tourists. And they aren't having much fun either.
Dorothy.
Are you sisters?
No.
Does everyone know?
Dee and Dorothy are from Glasgow, Scotland, and are having a panino on the steps of Santa Croce. But they wouldn't describe their day as much of a picnic.
There's so many guided tours with people, it's difficult to even know who your guide is and to understand what they're saying because there's so much noise going on round about.
The bell tower is original.
It's not just the increase in tourists every year that's a problem, but the behaviour. The sound of a shopkeeper hosing the sidewalk in front of her wine shop to stop tourists from picnicking there. In this one narrow street, you can see how tourists, all using the same social media reviews, can change the character of an historic area. One well-reviewed cafe here has hundreds of tourists jamming the street, waiting to get in. No one can see the wine store, let alone get in easily.
Qui c'è una barriera, non dà visibilità ai negozi, non c'è possibilità di entrare nei negozi.
The numbers of tourists are creating a barrier in the street, says the owner. She feels her traditional store will soon close, as many others have already done. Her phrase for the city?
Il degrado.
In steep decline. It's simple. The Florence that tourists want to see is changing, precisely because of all the people coming to see it. But what to do about all this is not simple. Some say access to the city should be limited. For now, there's a new campaign underway to manage the flow of visitors and to get the tourists themselves to take more responsibility. Paola Concia, Florence councillor in charge of tourism. Enjoy, Respect Firenze, or you'll get fined. Florence is, after all, a UNESCO World Heritage Site needing to be cared for and not buried alive by crowds.
Carlo Francini, I'm the site manager of the Historic Centre of Florence as a World Heritage Site.
UNESCO's Carlo Francini says over-tourism is a huge problem for the city, particularly fast tourism, as he calls the hordes of tourists that come just for the day from the ever bigger cruise ships that dock 2 hours away in Livorno.
I don't believe in the closure of the city because it's a contradiction with the status of the World Heritage. But the balance is very important because if the large number of tourists, the large number of people damage the integrity, the authenticity of the city, this is a problem, for not only for the Florentine, for all the world.
Francini is heading up a management plan encouraging tourists to explore the city beyond its three or four most famous sites. In Fiesole, on a hill just a few miles above Florence, I meet a mother and daughter who've done just that. Susan Burning and Rebecca Ames from Washington, D.C. They're in a lovely piazza, with a view back down to Florence, and no crowds. Rebecca describes a visit to the Church of Santa Croce, which encapsulates for her why some sort of resolution to the problem of over-tourism has to be found.
We were looking at all of the tombs, and we were in front of Galileo Galilei, and next to me was somebody from China, and there was somebody else from another country, and we were all completely not Italian, but we were all standing in front of this person whose ideas are fundamental to our lives. And so it's, I think in Florence especially, where so much came from here that is just the basis of science and thought and philosophy, that it does belong to everybody in a way. We grew up learning it.
But even Galileo and his telescope could not have foreseen the problems brought on by immense cruise ships, Airbnb-style accommodation, and cheap flights. In 1980, there were 300 million of us on the move worldwide for travel and tourism. This year, there are 1.3 billion. So it seems unlikely that the increasing tension between tourists, residents, and city officials is going to go away anytime soon.
1,300, 1,400, and 1,500. And the square on that occasion was decorated with beautiful stains.
For Here and Now, I'm Anna Benstead.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Yesterday on Fox News, President Trump made this prediction.
I'll tell you what, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor.
Impeachment is, of course, not at all a reality right now, but the president put it in play, and there's precedent to his prediction. During the Watergate scandal, stocks fell 42% from January 1973 to August 74, when Nixon resigned. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. Mike, we should say right at the outset, for impeachment to even be a thought, Democrats would have to take the House in November. But does the president have a point? Markets don't like turmoil.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate idiom that markets don't like turmoil. They don't like uncertainty. I do think the Nixon comparison, and a lot of people are making that comparison, but I think it's sort of an imperfect one because the country was also undergoing a recession in the run-up to Nixon's resignation. And there's one thing the market hates more than anything else. It's recession and problems with the economy. Mm-hmm. When it comes to a quote-unquote crash if Trump is impeached, I think it depends on how you define crash. I mean, most of us think of it as a huge 40-50% drop like that. I don't really think that would be in the cards in this case. I do think there could be some volatility in the markets and a dip of a much smaller magnitude. But it's hard to really picture long-lasting damage to the stock market from it.
Well, a portfolio manager at Merlin Asset Management told Politico that an impeachment would see a Washington Goldilocks situation because then you'd still have Trump's tax cuts. You'd have a deregulation, a President Pence who might de-escalate the trade war with China. And by the way, when we say impeachment, you know, that is a trial. But he meant if, in fact, it ended in the president leaving. So not everyone thinks it's a bad idea. But what about that idea that, you know, you'd still have deregulation because Pence would be coming in?
Right. I don't think that's that far-fetched of a scenario, actually. You know, as you say, most of the parts of the Trump agenda that are very friendly to the stock market are already in place. These massive tax cuts, huge sweeping deregulation. The threat would really be if the Democrats also take enough power in Congress that they decide to start undoing some of those things, and also enact, you know, some hypothetical other policies that would be unfriendly to equity markets, say a restriction on companies buying back their own stock.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the Dems really want to play that game, though, because I think it would be damaging for them to really come out too aggressive with policies that would put the stock market under pressure.
Yeah, we're just playing here, you know, because the president put it out there. I mean, it was interesting that he would just put it out there almost as if it were a threat. And it's so funny that you mentioned that Nixon, that there might have been other issues. The country was experiencing the oil shock from OPEC. There was the war in the Middle East. It is interesting that there were other elements as well, because now economists are saying that the market is overjuiced and there is a crash coming anyway.
Yeah, I think you'll find there's always someone predicting a crash somewhere, you know, like it's happy hour
like
somewhere.
Like the president.
There's always someone predicting a crash somewhere. I think right now the main fixation on Wall Street and around the world really is the path of interest rates and whether or not the Fed will react too aggressively.
Right. Something the president is unhappy about as well.
Exactly.
Michael Regan, senior editor, Bloomberg News. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
For playing with us.
The film Crazy Rich Asians earned $34 million in the U.S. in the first 5 days of its release. Black Panther earned more than $700 million in the States, only the third film in history to do so, both films with diverse casts. We're joined now by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, who's been thinking about this. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And usually your beat is television, but I know you follow the film industry as well. And you say we should not be surprised that these films with diverse casts have been doing so well.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, at UCLA, they have several studies that have shown that films and TV shows that have diverse casts tend to do better financially. And I think the lesson from Crazy Rich Asians, its success, and also the success of Black Panther, is that there is a hunger out there among film audiences for films that feature non-white casts that are culturally authentic and that also, you know, seem to be capturing something really special about the culture, about how we're talking about these issues, and about how this stuff is playing out in society. And so I think, you know, this idea that there's a risk in featuring big movies with non-white casts is maybe an outdated idea, because what we're seeing really is that there's a hunger out there for audiences for these films if they're done right and if they're done with care.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from Crazy Rich Asians. I haven't seen it yet, but this is a scene in which a group of Singapore matriarchs have their Bible study interrupted by the latest gossip.
Is Nikki bringing a girl to Colin's wedding? My Amanda heard it from her friend Francesca.
Eddie says her name is Rachel Chu.
Oh, I thought that Nick was coming alone. Did you know he had a girlfriend?
Nick dates many girls. It's hard to keep track.
Rachel Chu. Or maybe she's from the Taiwan Plastics Chu family.
If you want, I have a private investigator. Very discreet.
Eric, this has been a box office and critical success, but it does seem like Hollywood is still surprised that it's done so well.
I think, again, like I said, I think it's part of that sort of outmoded way of thinking about these issues. I did get the sense, you know, watching the approach to the release of both this movie and Black Panther, that Hollywood was kind of holding its breath a little bit and was concerned that, you know, if these movies came out and they weren't successful, what would it say about how the movie-going public feels about movies that are centered on non-white casts and on non-white cultures. But I think the message that we've gotten is exactly, you know, the opposite. And I think some of the typical tropes that we've heard about films that are centered on non-white casts, this idea that they don't perform well overseas, this idea that white audiences wouldn't be able to identify with characters, with films that don't have very many white characters in them. You know, these ideas are put to the lie by the success of these films, and it just sort of shows that we need to rethink. And Hollywood in particular needs to rethink how it approaches these issues when it comes to developing films and when it comes to deciding which films are going to get big budgets.
I do remember, though, films like Slumdog Millionaire, even the comedy Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, two films with Asian characters, South Asian and East Asian characters in them.
Yeah. I think people wind up seeing those films as anomalies. But I think the message here is that we need to be more expansive, and Hollywood in particular needs to be more expansive in how it views how these characters can be created. One of the things that I've noted, you know, I wrote a book called Race Baiter, where I talk a lot about how race works in media. And there's, you know, African Americans seem to be the furthest along this continuum. You know, I'm African American myself, and we've had a lot of experience in dealing with how our culture is portrayed in TV and film. And there almost seems to be a progression to it, where you have very stereotypical images, and then you have films and TV shows that are centered on special characters, where you'll have characters of color who stand out, but they're surrounded by white casts. And then slowly you get to the point where you have more inclusive casting. And then you get to the point where creators of color, writers and producers and directors get a chance to tell their stories. And then you really get, a wide diversity of depictions. And I sort of feel like with Asians and in particular with Latinos, we're just now getting to the point where Hollywood is allowing creators of color from those cultures to direct their own movies, to write their own movies. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, black folks have kind of been in this situation a little bit earlier, but now we're finally reaching that point with other non-white ethnic groups, and we're getting great movies out of it.
Well, speaking of African Americans in film, let's talk about Black Panther, because this film did so well. $700 million in the U.S. That's only the third film in history to do that. As we said, here's a scene from it. Black Panther confronts his nemesis in front of the royal family of the film's fictional country, Wakanda.
Only reason I don't kill you where you stand is because I know who you are. Now, what do you want?
I want the throne. Y'all sitting up here comfortable. Must feel good. It's about 2 billion people all over the world that looks like us. But their lives are a lot harder. Wakanda has the tools to liberate them all.
That was such a great movie. I loved watching that film. What about, though, the difference? I mean, you as we said, usually cover television. Is TV doing a better job than film of representing diversity?
I think in terms of diversity in front of the camera, definitely we're seeing a better level of diversity in the cast. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles earlier this summer talking to the producers and actors and TV executives about the fall TV season. And, you know, we're going to see more shows centered on Latino characters than we've ever seen before. We're seeing lots of shows on the big broadcast networks that have diverse casts. It's not quite as rosy a picture behind the scenes when we look at people who are allowed to create their own shows, who are allowed to be the top executive producers, even among the directing ranks. You know, there's a lot of work to be done in diversity behind the scenes. And what's interesting, you know, we played that clip from Black Panther, and in that one clip, we get a sense of African culture portrayed. We get a sense of African American culture portrayed. We get a sense of the tension between those two cultures. And I think this is what happens when you have a director, when you have script writers, and when you have a cast that is, of the culture. culture that they're talking about. And so they're able to really kind of get in there and really talk about some of the nuances in a way that might be harder for people who are outside of that culture to depict. It's not impossible, but I do think that's the thing that you get, that authenticity that you get when you allow people of color to tell their own stories. And now Hollywood is learning that you can make money doing that, right? So if we're not seeing that happen as much as it should, even after we have example after example of movies making money by doing that, then you have to ask, well, why isn't it happening? And mm-hmm. I think it's because we still have some of these outdated stereotypes about why people will go to see a movie or who will go to see a movie. And we need to take more chances and we need to kind of dispel those ideas.
You know, we spoke to Moctezuma Esparza, who is the director of Selena, and he's opening up all of these movie theaters in Latino neighborhoods. And he asked me when we were talking to name one Mexican-American film star. And I named a couple of people, and it turns out that, in fact, they're not Mexican-American. They're Mexican. His point was that, you know, people like Salma Hayek, Guillermo del Toro, that we don't have a lot of Mexican-American stars in this country. We have people that have come in from other countries, from Latino cultures that have come into this country and made it big. But that was his point. It's an interesting point that you know, in this country where we've got all this diversity, even on screen, it might not be what we think it is.
I think it points to how in America our Hollywood system still is severely underrepresenting Latino and Hispanic actors. And it might be easier for somebody who's made a name for themselves outside the country, somebody who's already seeming to become an up-and-coming star or is kind of a star in the Latin American film market, to come to America and say, hey, I've already proven I can do this in Latin mm-hmm. America. Mm-hmm. Give me a shot at America. Whereas Mexican-American and Latino-American and Hispanic-American actors who are in America don't have that shot. And so they can't necessarily prove what they can do in the same way.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The annual Burning Man Festival is set to begin in Nevada Sunday. The now infamous gathering brings together artists, people from the tech community, and a fair amount of recreational drug use. LSD, ecstasy, mushrooms, not new to the culture of Silicon Valley, but now the use of drugs is becoming much more mainstream, according to Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode. She has an opinion piece in the New York Times about it, and she joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Kara.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. And let's talk about why you wrote this piece, because as a tech journalist, you say you've mm-hmm. been offered a number of these drugs in meetings with executives.
Yeah, it's been increasing. It's never really happened, but they're so sort of embracing it. I think maybe after marijuana was legalized here in California, people feel more comfortable with drugs and talking about them publicly. And so you go to parties and people mention it, and they're using it not in the way of like, hey, let's party. It's more let's free our mind a little bit more, or get into a lucid state, or we have better ideas and things like that. So it's a lot less of an issue. There's no sneaking around about it at all.
What kind of drugs are you talking about?
Well, I haven't tried any of them, I'll be honest with you. I'm sort of boring and prudish that way. But a lot, you know, LSD, microdosing LSD and things like that, which has been, you know, it's been happening for a few years, but it's really pretty widespread now, as far as I can tell. Mushrooms, to the same thing. You know, some people are trying ketamine, but it's all in a microdosing sense, which is small amounts of it, in order to come to some revelations, essentially. And then there's the party drugs like ecstasy, which people obviously continue to use since college, I guess. But those are not quite the same thing. And I think there's some cocaine use, but that's not really what's going on. It's more, as I wrote in the article, is sort of to intellectualize drugs in order to come to new conclusions and to take, you know, to come to new ideas, essentially.
Are these people who work in Silicon Valley able to tell you, like, this is something that I came up with because I was taking a drug, I was microdosing?
Yeah, they do. Like, it started, I think, a little bit with people attempting to use ayahuasca to do that, to come to new revelations and think of new ideas. I think what it does is it, several people have told me they've come up with concepts at work and things like that, as long as they do it in a way where they're not out of it, where they're lucid. And they compare it to the movie that wasn't a very good movie called Limitless with Bradley Cooper, where they just get slightly more intelligent and it gives them a slight more insight. And so it frees them from the daily stress of what might be on top of it, and then on top of them, and then moves into a better place. Michael Pollan, who's a really well-known journalist, right, who writes a lot about food, actually has written a book about this, the increased use of psychedelics and more research going into the idea that it will help PTSD and depression. And a lot of it is being funded by tech people.
There are some who may look at this with concern, including investors in companies, sure, in Silicon Valley. And that brings us to Tesla's Elon Musk, right? I mean, people were concerned when he said that he wanted to go private with Tesla and that he wanted the stock price to be $420, that he was high at the time.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, he denied it in an interview later with the New York Times, although obviously he was making a joke. He just was. I think he was. I think most people think he was. And I think the board was concerned with, he said he was on Ambien, I guess, or the board, or some people, he didn't say it, but some of the board members were insinuating in the Times.
Poor Ambien, by the way. Isn't that what Roseanne said that she was on when she sent that tweet too?
Yeah. Yeah. No Ambien in Twitter,
right,
I guess.
Exactly.
That's what you can't be doing. But, you know, I think, and then they mentioned in a sort of a quaint way, the use of recreational drugs. And so, you know, I think, is it concerning when Fortune 500 CEOs drink too much? I don't know. Like, do we talk about that very much? And so I think that's something that's sort of titillating to a lot of people, but I just think it's the version of drinking or something else. So I don't know. I'm not very judgy. I live here in San Francisco, California. Right. But
well, and it's legal, by the way, to use marijuana now in California, which a lot of them are doing.
Are you kidding? Yeah, everywhere. Like, you go to events now and everybody's vaping right in front of you. It's not seen as in any way as a socially problematic thing. That's for sure. It's a little more like Amsterdam or wherever now here. And in other states too, not all of them, but this one for sure.
Do you think that this is a fad in Silicon Valley, or is this here to stay?
No, I think it's here to stay. Some of this research, if you read Michael's book, which is just an amazing book, it's called Changing Your Mind, I think some of this research going into the uses of LSD and other substances like it, which are not like opiates, you know, it's a really interesting thing. If the LSD has sort of been tagged in this sort of counterculture San Francisco abuse kind of way, and I think there's some really interesting research, you know, which needs to be done and checked and stuff. You can't just use it on your own. There could be some really interesting things to handle issues that we've had, such as depression and PTSD and other things. And I'm glad people are researching it, because if there's a way to get off of opiates or other painkillers, that would be great, too.
Well, it's a great column. I hope people will read it. We'll link to it at hereandnow.org. Kara Swisher, executive editor at Recode, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Are you getting some good ideas now?
Well, I'm just thinking that there are a lot of people sitting in jail for minor drug infractions who might be getting a little ticked off.
The people in Silicon Valley can just use
Woo-hoo!
Them. Right.
Hey, what's this music?
It's getting near dawn. When lights close the tired eyes, I'll soon be with you, my love.
With that, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
I'll be with you when the stars start falling. I've been waiting so long to be where I'm going in the sun.